Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What qualities make a photograph unforgettable? We are so bombarded with images in the modern world that we don't bother to pay attention to most of them. But a tiny fraction of the very best photographs don't give us a choice. They command our attention, compel us to roam all over them with our eyes, and invite us to ask questions, search for meaning, or simply admire the artistry of their composition. Annie Griffiths has spent a career in pursuit of such rare and wonderful images. She was one of the first women photographers on staff at National Geographic, and in her long career has taken pictures in nearly 150 countries. Her new book, Stunning Photographs, is a collection of images, largely by other acclaimed photojournalists, accompanied by Griffiths' essays on what makes certain pictures so powerful. Annie, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It really is amazing that we can have video of anything today. We're not limited. Everybody's got a high-definition camera in their pocket. And yet we continue to be drawn to these single moments in time on two dimensions.
Absolutely. In fact, I think even in a video, there are moments that carry the story. And there's something about freezing a moment in time that gives people a chance to consider what they're seeing, a chance to like kind of sit with it for a little while. So I'm a huge fan of still photography.
I hadn't really thought about it until I was reading your essays, but it occurred to me that at least in my experience, a lot of memories look more like photographs than films. I experience them, in four dimensions, but my brain kind of records stills.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. I mean, I cast back to my childhood and I have images of myself. I can almost get outside my body and see myself behind the sofa poring over magazines, and I'd hide behind the sofa and I could see my feet walking to school. It's a powerful memories are often contained in a single visual.
You start this book with a reminder that there is an art not just to creating visual images, but there's an art to seeing. Can you talk about how we can cultivate our ability to absorb everything a photograph has to give us?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I know, for example, because I'm not a musician, I know that if I sit and listen to a beautiful piece of music, I may enjoy it, but I will never hear as much as a trained musician will hear. And the same is true with photography. The more you look at compelling images, the more you kind of raise your visual acuity and you start noticing light and texture, shadows, and things that maybe you missed when you started out because you were just taking the picture of the thing. And the truth is that great photographs always have a combination of light and composition and moment.
What was it like to compile images for this book? I mean, I have to imagine the possibilities were endless, and it really is, I mean, stunning is absolutely the right word for every single image in this book, but I would think it would be maddening to try and choose.
No, it's like a love fest. National Geographic has the most amazing archive, and one of my favorite things to do is to go diving into that archive of millions of pictures and look for a set of pictures, especially those that have never been published, you can almost, it's like setting a butterfly free or something. So to me, it is one of my favorite things in the world to do.
One of your photographs in the book is this great picture of four little kids in Brazil just sort of playing and standing around with holding some papaya leaves. Can you tell us about what happened surrounding that image?
Sure. In addition to my magazine work, I've always done aid work. And that picture was actually taken for a project I did for Habitat for Humanity. And I was trying to illustrate the word shelter, to give a sense of what it means to a person to have dignified shelter. And so I was in Brazil shooting at it at a build, and these little guys were just making rooftops out of these gigantic leaves. And at one point, one of them just put his head back and closed his eyes, and boom, it was perfect.
Do you have to get really close to get these pictures, or is there a lot of cropping that comes in afterwards?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that happens if you work for a magazine for many, many years where you're shooting on slide film, on transparency film, because when you present your work, you can't do any cropping. And so you become a very good editor in the camera, which is something that I always encourage when I teach photography, is to get as close as possible to what you want the final product to be. So yes, move, get in close, get low, get high. And that kind of activity of hunting for the perfect image is, it makes you just much more aware and much more fluid and much pickier about what's in there. I think now with digital, people can get very sloppy, professionals also, and say, well, I'll just fix it later on a computer. That's no way to take pictures.
I suppose it is true that if you know that you can take 1,000 shots of something and not have to worry about how much the film is costing you, then you're not really, as you say, you're sort of shooting and not seeing.
It can be that way. I mean, I really personally feel that the fact that you don't have to pay for each click of the frame with digital has been a creative gift to professionals as well as amateurs, because it encourages creativity and it encourages just messing around and trying things. And I think that's fantastic. But it also, you know, can get people kind of back on their heels and sort of madly shooting without really seeing.
Once you have found a subject, how do you begin the process of figuring out how you will depict it with your camera?
Well, it is a process. It's kind of like choreography. When you're in a situation that seems like it's going somewhere, you just stay with it, and you may get one good picture, but then you don't quit. You stay with it because you might get a better one and a better one. And it's, you know, at the end of a photographic session, you should be sweating, you should be hungry, you know, your eyes should be stinging. And that's the fun of it. It's almost athletic in the pursuit part of it, where you forget about everything else.
Of course, when you're doing documentary work, there are just so many things beyond your control, right?
Oh, yes, but that's true in almost everything I photograph. As a photojournalist, you're not supposed to control anything. And the joy and the reality of working that way is so much more gratifying, because you don't know what's going to happen. You just stay with it and hope that you are poised for the exact right moment. And it's a huge privilege to be with people as a documentary photographer, and that's the lion's share of what I do. To just be someplace in the middle of nowhere with people who take you in, and they've never heard of National Geographic. They're just being kind, and they're just kind of touched that anyone is interested in them. That's as good as it gets.
Do you think patience is part of your skill set? I mean, is that as important as knowing how to shoot and understanding the workings of the camera?
Well, it's interesting. It would be an interesting question to ask my children.
All bets are off.
Because as a photographer, I actually am very patient. But, you know, the most patient photographers on earth are the wildlife photographers, because they, you know, their desire to show real action and real animal behavior is so great that they torture themselves. They'll be spending days and sometimes weeks in a blind that's uncomfortable and hot, and all of them are thoroughly bug bitten and come home with unpleasant diseases and things. So, you know, it does, and it should. You know, if it were easy to get great pictures, then everybody would be doing it. But earning the right to get something new and fresh takes a real commitment.
What does it take when you have maybe an idea, a vision of what something might be, to stay open enough to cast that aside when something better comes along. And I'll explain it this way. I'm no photographer, but I have a camera and I have kids. And particularly when they were young, I would have in my mind, I was waiting for that moment when they would do the thing that I wanted them to do in the picture. And of course, it never happened. And I missed a lot of opportunities to catch real moments.
Yeah, and it happens to me on every assignment. When I go, I have a mental list of what I think I'm going to find and capture. And, you know, after about 48 hours, I could just throw the list away because what happens in real life is always so much more interesting.
How do you define mystery in a photograph?
Oh, it's one of my favorite things. In fact, the mystery chapter of this book was just so wonderful to do. It's when there's an enigmatic quality to the image, and in large part, it's often attributed to the light or lack of light. So, if just a piece of an image has light on it, and there are, you know, shadowy areas, that's one kind of way to examine mystery. It depends on mood, and you know, there are wonderful moods that happen in stormy weather or when you really, really make eye contact with a subject where suddenly you feel like you're seeing into the soul of that person. So mystery comes in lots of ways, but it just makes you want to know more.
Do you deliberately try to bring that to particular images that you create, or is it something that is kind of that is beyond what you want to make? I'm not sure if I explained that very well.
No, I think I understand. I would say that I respond to what's happening. And so if I'm with somebody who's kind of creepy, I'll want to show that creepiness. Mm-hmm. If I'm with someone who is sort of lost and confused, I'll seek to show that in their eyes. And there are other mysteries that happen just because the image almost seems incomplete. Something is passing before the camera out of focus, or there's a juxtaposition between the foreground and the background. So it's, as a photographer, you're more going with whatever is before you and then trying to compose it in a way that is complete.
Are you thinking about engaging other senses besides sight when you're shooting?
Gosh, that's such a great question. Well, I'm usually listening at a pretty serious level, and kind of listening with my whole body. I don't think about smell very much. In fact, I work in a lot of very bad places, so I try to override that particular sense. But I do. I mean, I'm very touchy feely when I'm with people. I'm very, I'm really with them, and I get close to people very quickly. So, I guess I do. But what's really happening is a translation of whatever those other senses are into the still image.
My guest is National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. We're talking about her new book, Stunning Photographs, which is a collection of images by a number of acclaimed photojournalists, including Griffiths, accompanied by her essays. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths about her new book, Stunning Photographs. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I love your description of photographs as origami in reverse. Can you explain what you mean by that phrase?
Well, you know, it's interesting because origami is taking a flat, you know, one-dimensional piece of paper and folding it into, you know, into a three-dimensional object. And photography is like taking this three-dimensional world and turning it into a single surface. And yet retaining that dimensionality, retaining the graphic and textural nature of real life.
So you want to have structure in a great photograph, but you don't necessarily want it to call attention to itself?
Right. I mean, sometimes you do. Sometimes it's the absolute, you know, in-your-face graphics of something that make it interesting. But a lot of times those, you know, lines and the geometry of the photograph can be very subtle and you don't even see it. In fact, I was a little bit horrified when I realized how much math was involved in photography because that was not a good subject for me. But, you know, really when you start looking at leading lines, you know, and you see how they take you through a still photograph and you've got curves and you've got, believe it or not, lots and lots of triangles. It's amusing. I mean, honestly, because when I am in the situation as I'm composing, I'm not aware of that geometry at all, but innately I am. I mean, I am aware of the division of the frame and I am aware of certainly of the things that should be left out of the frame, which is just as important as anything you leave in the frame.
Is there a danger in overthinking what you're shooting as you're shooting?
Sure. Sure. I remember as a young photographer, somebody told me that I needed to come up with a style, that I, you know, that great photographers had styles, that someone could pick their pictures out anywhere. And I really wrestled with that because I did not see a style in my work. And it was only when I stopped worrying about it that the style actually emerged.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Hello, Ms. Griffith. I have a question for you. I'm just wondering if you've had to learn over the years to kind of go easy on yourself when you just miss what might have been the perfect photograph. The example that I think of is when Jack Ruby very famously shot Oswald in 1963 in right here in Dallas. And there were two photographers, one with the Dallas Times Herald that won the Pulitzer Prize, and one with the Dallas Morning News who caught an image that was about two-thirds of a second too soon. And one of the books
is that
despondency over missing that photograph followed him all of his days. I'd just like to see what your reaction is to missing the so-called perfect photograph.
Well, you know, when you've got a breaking news event and you feel, you know, that your job is to make sure that you capture any important moment, it's sort of a different deal than when you miss moments in everyday shooting or on assignments. But, oh, certainly I've missed some. And so if they're honest, every single one of my colleagues has. Each and every one of us has forgotten to put film in the camera at one time in our life. You know, we're so imperfect, but I don't let any of that stuff haunt me. It's it'll bug you for a while, but honestly, you know, there are so many more great pictures to pursue that's what I try to focus on.
Are you out of sorts if you don't have access to a camera?
No. Not at all. I'm very comfortable. I'm, you know, extremely comfortable not having a camera with me. And I think that's because I'm also a mother. And when my children were little, they traveled all over the world with me. But the camera meant that I was working. And so people assume I have endless photographs of my own kids, but that's actually not the case because they really didn't want to see a camera. When I was with them, I was with them. And that was a great lesson for me to understand that, you know, my Uncle John doesn't bring his stethoscope to family gatherings, and I really shouldn't feel obligated to bring a camera.
It must be hard to travel light when you're traveling with small children and photographic gear.
Oh, it's a nightmare. I mean, flight attendants see you coming and flee. You know, they. But I was very good at you know, packing smart. So people tease me because I was the only photographer that packed my lenses in Pampers when the kids were little. But it was true. They were actually great padding. It was a lot of stuff, although I got very good at minimizing the stuff, and I had so much fun traveling with my children, and they became such great travelers, and they also have really become great citizens of the world. Mm. They have a wonderful perspective on things.
I would imagine having them along also saved you from maybe the risk of becoming like an obsessive workaholic, right? Because you had to quit at a certain time every day and you had to have a life.
Yeah. Having a life is, I think, a really important people for those who would be workaholics. I think it's it saves you on a lot of levels. And you know, having children also made me much more empathetic to every other human being. I always was pretty much that way, but you go to a deeper level.
What is the difference between a photograph that is ultimately passive and maybe doesn't work and one that is simply quiet, as you describe it?
Oh, that's a great question. I think when something feels sort of passive, it's probably because there wasn't enough attention paid to the light. Something can be extremely quiet, but if it's just touched by light, and it can be extremely delicate light, it literally ignites the photograph. So that's one difference. But it also could be a gesture. You know, there could be sort of a nice picture of someone, but it's when they pause and rub their eyes that something happens, or when they tilt their head, or when there's a human touch in the subject.
Is most body language universal? I mean, I know that there are certain gestures that mean one thing in one part of the world.
Oh boy, are there. Yeah.
But I wonder if other things, facial expressions, are those pretty universal?
I would say, yes, the expressions are universal. Different cultures are more or less expressive. You know, there are cultures where there's not a lot of smiling. Mm-hmm. There are cultures where there's just, sort of an innocent warmth to anyone who comes in their lives. But when things are really good or really bad, the expressions you're likely to see are very similar. And when people need something, need touch or need attention or need acknowledgement, it's a very similar kind of, and very small facial changes that you can see.
Knowing that your audience, the people who see these photographs, might not be sensitive to those differences, that what is actually, you know, like a big expression for the people that you are photographing, do you have to, mm-hmm. I mean, how do you, in what way do you serve as a sort of translator so that the intended audience will understand how profound a moment is?
Well, that's the job. Mm-hmm. The job is to make people stop and feel something. And certainly in certain situations, if it's part of a broader story, that helps. So you have context. And then again, captions and text give tremendous context to things. But you, as a photographer, you're really trying to have it come across in the frame, even if it comes across sort of subtly.
Are there, when you're working in a part of the world where something like direct eye contact is considered invasive or not polite or only for people that you're really intimately acquainted with, boy, a camera is like direct eye contact on steroids, right?
Well, it can be. I mean, you can assault someone with a photo or with a camera, or you can amazingly help the camera to disappear. And I've always been blown away by how quickly people kind of get over the fact that this silly woman is taking pictures and go back to real life. A lot of it is how you approach them. It's all about trust, there are so many physical things you can do. You know, if I travel to a poor area, I go looking pretty poor. You kind of become a chameleon. I never carry a camera bag. I never wear a photo vest. I've just got everything in a backpack, and I go very light. It's sort of doing everything in your power to not be intimidating. And then when I approach people, either after I've photographed them or when I want to photograph them, I do the same kind of body language that you can see in other species. You know, I go down on my knee. I take on a non-threatening position. And people are often completely unaware of it, but it helps them feel safe.
You've been in so many different parts of the world that may be unfamiliar to people other than through your photographs. And I'm wondering, I get a clear sense looking at your work that you see every subject as an individual who has a personality and a temperament different from the person next to them. But then, based on the nature of your work, they do sort of function as a kind of archetype of their culture, of their place in time or space. And is that tension something that you struggle with?
No, because when I'm with people, I see them as individuals, very much so. I don't see them as a group. And in each, in each culture, there are really charming things and alarming things that you can focus on. But I think I was fortunate in that I've also photographed in every one of the 50 states here. So I've, as a photographer, I've become aware of our own culture and that we're just as exotic as, the next guy when you stand back and look at it. And so I go into a lot of situations with a little bit of a twinkle, a sense of humor, to try to draw out the individual within the situation.
So you can't just, declare, okay, I'm going to add wit to this photograph. I mean, you can certainly strive for that, but it takes, as you stress in the book, a lot of attention and a recognition that it doesn't necessarily happen only by accident.
Right. And I think it's also a lot of witty photographs involve great timing. Mm-hmm. It's just like comedy. Great timing where the photographer is ready and then something you could not possibly have anticipated happens and you get it. But it's also sort of, walking down the street with a lightness, with enjoying everything that's happening around you. When I'm in New York City, I always get accosted by any Jehovah's Witness, anybody, because I don't realize it, but I'm smiling most of the time. So I look like a rube. And
you're very approachable. We'll put it that way.
I'm very approachable. And it's because I'm enjoying the people watching so much, even if I'm not shooting.
Hmm. You've also been in situations that are very hard to be witness to, and I wonder the extent to which you feel it's appropriate to show those emotions, or do you feel like they maybe add something to the scene that otherwise wouldn't exist?
Well, I work in a lot of difficult situations because I run a nonprofit of geographic photographers called Ripple Effect Images, and we document programs that are sustainable and innovative for women and girls in the emerging world. And so I'm in a lot of circumstances that are sad, but as long as you honor the person, I mean, that's so important to me. Where National Geographic is doing a project right now with Feeding America, and a lot of amateur photographers are submitting pictures. And the ones that succeed are ones where you can clearly tell this photographer spent time with those people. There's a relationship. The ones that fail are usually where it's just a sad person sleeping on the street, or somebody who's, you know, mentally incompetent, or, you know, those kinds of things, which are simple reactions. They're not an investment in the people. But as soon as you cross that, you know, as soon as you cross that bridge to the human heart and spend time with people and honor them, even sad pictures become, you know, can have a lot of beauty to them.
Does a photograph of someone sleeping on the street, does it fail because that's an image we already have sort of banked and we already associate with the problems of something like homelessness?
No, I think it. There are pictures of people sleeping on the street that are fabulous, are just beautiful, mm-hmm. in their thoughtfulness and in their artistry. Most of them are just grab shots. You know, most of them are not, the photographer doesn't employ any real involvement, much less relationship, and it's more it's people as things, not as human beings.
We're speaking this hour with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths about her new book, Stunning Photographs, which is a collection of images by a number of acclaimed photojournalists, including Griffiths, accompanied by her essays on photography. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with National Geographic photographer Annie Griffiths. Her new book is called Stunning Photographs. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Annie, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was that you've had the opportunity to shoot in all 50 states, and there are things that are unique to the United States and American culture that would seem exotic elsewhere. Can you talk about some of the things you think that would be noticeable to people who came in with a camera from another place and were trying to understand about Americans?
Oh, gosh, yes. There are so many things. I mean, right here in Texas, I think one of the most iconic visions of the American culture is the cowboy. Mm. And when I've photographed, cattle brandings and cattle drives and things like that, It does feel very exotic to me, you know, just the traditions and the way, you know, kind of the way people walk and hold themselves and the, you know, the relationship of people with their animals and the humor, the kind of silliness, and all of it is uniquely our culture. And I remember being at the World Polka Festival in Minnesota and thinking, boy, you just can't make this stuff up. It's so great. And it's, it's almost like we all have a team, you know, whether it's athletics or not. We all have our little, kind of our core cultural traditions that comfort us and that we come to care about deeply I think it starts when you're a little kid and you come back to it later in life. And we're funny, you know. One of my favorite stories was this little guy who I was at a cattle branding, and he was 7 years old. He wanted me to photograph him wrestling a steer, and so he came up and goes, "You won't see me wrestle a steer?" And I said, "Sure, honey." And so he walks over and starts wrestling this little calf who doesn't move an inch. And when he finishes, it's actually the picture because he's all sweaty and proud and everything. And the calf is just standing there looking at me. I said, "Does your little calf have a name?" He goes, "Yep, name's Michelangelo." And I thought, I really was impressed, you know, that this kid out in the Western United States named his calf for one of the greatest artists that had ever lived. And then he goes, "I got some other ones back at the barn named for the other Ninja Turtles." You know, and it's both sides of that are just purely American.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Hank in Plano. Hey, Hank.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I haven't been listening from the start of the show, but I was curious to get some feedback on how the digitization of photography and the inherent ability to manipulate color and light, how that has affected the speaker's sense of appreciation of professionalism. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I think the thing that the general public doesn't know is that photographers have always had the ability to alter reality, you know. But now that Photoshop is in the hands of millions, I think there's an assumption that this is a whole new world and that you couldn't used to do that stuff. The truth is, when it comes to color and things like that, you can tell if it looks plastic. You know, it doesn't look real. You know, if a pair of blue jeans looks electric blue, then you know somebody's been monkeying around with the actual color in the image. Same with, you know, there are really great indicators like trees, and we know what grass looks like, and so I think if the biggest fault is that people kind of overdo it a lot, and then as they get over the new toy, then I think they start coming back to a more realistic look at the world. But with journalists, the only thing that we are allowed to do is the same thing we always did in a dark room, which is you can crop and you can lighten a dark area, and you can darken a light area, and you can add some contrast, but that's really all that a journalist does, and that's all we have ever done. So to alter reality, to start adding things to photographs or really change them, is as big a sin for a photojournalist as plagiarism is for a writer. And if you do it, you'll get fired.
We have an email here from Michelle who says, "I saw Annie Griffiths at the Opera House in Dallas 2 years ago. She spoke with me after the event and inspired me to pursue a job with an international nonprofit. I spent 2 years photographing people in West Africa who received medical care from Mercy Ships. It was a life-changing experience, and I just wanted to pass on my thanks to Annie."
Oh, that's lovely. How nice.
I suppose there must be something wonderful about doing work that has the power to inspire people to do wonderful things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my mantra is when I consider what I want to spend time doing is I want my work to be useful as well as beautiful. I want it to have impact beyond my personal little career.
In the same way that, like, Olympic figure skaters make it look really easy, really gifted photojournalists make it look really easy. You know, some pictures I think everyone can understand that there was a lot involved technically, and yet others, I would imagine you can look at a photograph and recognize how much it took to get it, whereas the average viewer just thinks, well, that's a good picture. I've got a pretty good camera at home. I could do the same thing. Is that frustrating to you?
No, I think it's natural, you know. I think it doesn't frustrate me because Like anything, I mean, I think sometimes we think that doctors, what they do is easy, or lawyers, or chefs, or, you know, so many careers, if you aren't immersed in it, you think, hey, that doesn't look so bad. And photography is the same way. So it's kind of cute sometimes. People say things to me. I remember one time this like 17-year-old boy came up to me after a presentation, and he just kind of put his thumbs in his belt loops and said, you know, I wouldn't mind having your job. What do you say?
What did you say? Did you say, all right, we'll get, you know, 30 years from now, call me?
I just laughed. I said, well, go get it, son. You know, but, you know, the job itself is not what most people think. I mean, a lot of people say, well, it must be nice to just get paid for traveling around taking pictures. And that's a nice dream. But it's a very serious undertaking. And it's very intimidating, because you work among people who are working so hard, and they're so talented and committed. So, you know, you become your own worst boss, because you don't want to be the one that comes back with the mediocre story. You know, so nobody knows when you're out in the field. Nobody knows if you even get up. You have to be incredibly self-motivated, and you know that all your colleagues are doing it just as hard and fast as you are. So you want to make them proud.
Whose opinion matters to you of your work?
You ask the best questions.
Thank you.
Whose opinion matters? I think it's changed over the years. I think early on, whoever was my boss, you know, I wanted him to be happy. I wanted him to be pleased and impressed and stuff. And then it went really to the National Geographic writ large, you know, the team. I wanted to be respected, and I wanted the stories to resonate with the readers. And now I just, what matters most to me is that these pictures are used for good, and that, that people really do learn and understand things better because of the stories I tell.
Do you feel like the world is like moving in a positive direction, or do you feel like sometimes that based on what you've documented, we tend to be circular in the kinds of problems that we have and the things that keep us from being our best selves?
Well, I think there are some very dire things in this world. I think technology has created the ability for us to obliterate ourselves. That's pretty scary. I also think that we have created a climate nightmare that is going to be a really long, hard battle back from. In that case, I mean, some of those things are worse, I guess. But I think to a great extent, we just get bombarded by 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, breaking news. Mm-hmm. What's sad to me is that there isn't nearly enough coverage of successes and of potential and of resilience. And I hope the public demands that, because there's so many wonderful things and so many really sad things that the world largely doesn't even know, because everything gets focused on tragic breaking news.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bob on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bob.
Hello. Thanks for speaking to us. You're a great speaker. I can see why you're popular with the Speakers Bureau. I've been a photographer for many years in many different ways, and one of the problems I've seen in many instances is when the camera interferes with being part of the moment. And how do you keep that from happening? How do you keep the camera itself from being a barrier between you and what's going on?
Well, you know, it's funny, because when I'm shooting, I forget that the camera's up. I'm still talking to people and laughing, and, you know, I'm moving around. But if I sense that it is suddenly there is a barrier, then I put it down for a while, you know. And there are situations where somebody, you know, somebody really needs some help. I remember one time I was photographing this absolutely wonderful woman in South Dakota, and she was, it was a very, really interesting story. I won't go into it, but while I was there, she was taking care of three grandkids, and she popped them in the tub, and the phone rang, and she had to go get something. And so I just said, look, I'll take care of the kids, you know. And so I had a towel over my shoulder, and I'm washing the little kids, and I get, you know, and then I drain the water, and I'm getting them out, and the doorbell rings. And so I go to the door, and I've got this towel over my shoulder and these wet babies, and this, it was somebody from the local newspaper, and he said, I understand there's a National Geographic photographer here. I said, you're looking at her. But, you know, that part of earning the right to get into moments with people is to be a little intimate with them, you know, to clear your dishes, you know, just be a human being.
I guess it's part of risk-taking that we don't necessarily think of that kind of risk-taking when we think about great photographers. We think about, you know, nailing yourself to a, you know, tying yourself to a tree or climbing a mountain. But there's risk-taking with intimacy, right?
Oh, it's probably the biggest fear that most young photographers have is they love to take pictures of flowers and things that hold still, and but they have a hard time confronting their own shyness. And so often they'll say, oh, well, I don't want to interfere. Oh, that person might get mad at me. You know, they'll put it on the subject when, in fact, it's their own shyness. And I kind of liken it to wanting to go swimming, but you're afraid that water might feel a little cold, so, you know, you just dip your toe in and walk away, or you just jump in. And jumping in is so much fun. And a lot of times when I teach photography, I help my students jump in.
You don't strike me as someone who was ever shy, but is this something you've overcome?
Shyness?
Yeah.
I am shy, actually. I'm outgoing. It's an interesting dilemma, I guess. If I have a job to do, if I, you know, if I'm working, I can be very outgoing. But if I'm at a big, huge cocktail party and I don't know anybody, I just want to crawl in a hole. So a little bit of each, which I think helps me relate to people of different confidence levels.
Annie Griffiths is a National Geographic photographer. Her new book, Stunning Photographs, is a collection of images by a number of acclaimed photojournalists, accompanied by her essays and comments. Annie, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. It's been delightful.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Mashal Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.